I'm very pleased to be holding this event today on eminent domain. Steven Pinson will help introduce this evening. He's a curator of photography at the New York Public Library and the curator of this most extraordinary exhibition, and he'll tell you a little bit about it. It's a subject which I know very little about. I always say that I have holes in my culture so it can breathe, but as I understand it, eminent domain is very connected to a topic that has always been of great interest to me, which is the topic of collective memory. There's one particular sociologist in France who mattered to me very much, named Maurice Albvax, and he spoke in a book called Collective Memory. He spoke about what happens to people in a neighborhood, to citizens in a neighborhood, when the neighborhood is destroyed. What happens to their memories? And I'm sure we will be discussing this a little bit tonight. It is a pleasure also to be welcoming all the panelists. Marshall Berman in particular has mattered to me so very deeply. He wrote a book which I encourage all of you to get tomorrow. It is called All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. Please do get it. Now, to introduce the evening, I would like to introduce you to Kimberly Irwin, who is an associate manager of public programs. She works very, very closely with me, and she really has put this evening together. Kimberly Irwin.
Thanks, Paul. Well, like most of you here tonight, I think I have a sense of what eminent domain is, but I think what I don't know is how could it really affect my life? How could it really affect my Brooklyn neighborhood, and how can my city really be changed by the government exercising its power of eminent domain? So tonight we have a program with filmmaker Michael Galinsky, who will moderate a discussion with Marshall Berman, with Tom Angotti, with Mindy Fulilove, with Brian Berger, and I think they're gonna help us to understand this idea, this concept of eminent domain and how it has essentially created our past, our present, and how we can imagine, or maybe we can't even imagine, but we're gonna try tonight how it affects our future. And this evening would not have happened if it wasn't for Steven Pinson, who, as Paul has mentioned, is curator of photography, and of this extraordinary exhibition that is now being presented at the library. And also I'd like to thank Jason Dubs, who is also working with Steven and was a photography assistant on this exhibition. And also Lives Meg Stemler, who Paul and I just couldn't exist without. She's assistant in Live and just does everything for us. And she helped tremendously with tonight's event. And lastly, I want to thank Paul Holdengraver, who is director of Live, who not only continues to make those lions roar, I swear he's going to start making them dance pretty soon. So as he says, stay tuned, because we have a very exciting fall season coming up. I'd like to read what two of the artists in this exhibition have described in the catalog, which is available tonight for purchase from the library exhibition, Eminent Domain, Contemporary Photography and the City. And the first one comes from Zoe Leonard. I like the way my neighborhood grounded me in the world with physical evidence of the past, of who and when and how. I began to realize I would miss all this, so I started taking pictures. I wanted a record. There is something more here than quaintness or nostalgia. It is a feeling of connectedness to the rest of the world, to language and economy, to history and struggle, to the endless supply of human solutions, to the problem of survival. And the second quote comes from Glenn Ligon, who has shared his personal narrative of all his many places that he's inhabited in the city. And at the end, he states, "My mother's dream was that she would end her days in a little yellow house in the country. She passed away, as I probably will, living in an apartment building with neighbors above and below. I was born here in New York, and like many other New Yorkers, I lack imagination. The idea of living somewhere else has never occurred to me. Indeed, to live in New York is to have lived everywhere. After the event, you can buy books from the exhibition, from our authors on stage. We work with 192 Books, independent bookseller here in New York City. And I think there's going to be some signing of books, which is very exciting. And now Steven Pinson has even another exciting thing to announce. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. I just want to give a little bit of a brief introduction and context for the exhibition for those of you who may not have had the opportunity to see it yet, just to sort of introduce how it led to tonight's program. The exhibition presents the work of six artists: Thomas Holton, Bettina Yohe, Reiner Leist, Zoe Leonard, Ethan Levitas, and Glenn Ligon. All of the artists have completed recent projects that take on the theme of the city in very different ways. As I was putting the show together about a year ago, city officials had proposed regulations that would have required over $1 million in liability insurance for photographers to work in the streets of the city. At the same time, there was growing debate over the new forms of private-public arrangements that now characterize many of the large redevelopment projects underway in the city. Debate has been especially strong when eminent domain, or the taking of private property for public use, has been threatened or used. Objectors in both cases to the proposed regulations against photography and to the development projects felt there was an increasing danger of the privatization of public space. The way in which these two broad movements came together suggested the theme of this exhibition. While none of the artists' work specifically address the law of eminent domain, all of the projects deal in different ways and to varying degrees with the changing nature of space in New York City today. The concept of eminent domain is used as a lens or filter to raise questions that resonate with current debates about the shifting of public and private space, whether through gentrification, globalization, or the suburbanization of the city. For that reason, I'm particularly happy that tonight's program is one outgrowth of the exhibition. And I'd also like to thank Jason, Meg, Kim, and Paul for all of their hard efforts to bring tonight's program together. And also, I'd like very much to point out that four of the artists of the exhibition are with us tonight on the front row: Bettina Yohe, Reiner Leist, Thomas Holton, and Ethan Levitas. And thank you. I'm also very happy to announce that we've been able to arrange to keep the exhibition open for those of you that would like to visit it on your way out of the library this evening. So without further ado, we're going to begin the program. Thank you very much.
That's a trailer about the Atlantic Yards project and a film we're making about it. And tonight's discussion will focus on eminent domain, but it won't really focus on the minutiae of what's happening there. It's just kind of a jumping off point for discussion, as is the photo show. But I do want to say, if I can find my notes, you know, if you came here by car or subway or even walking tonight, you were aided and abetted by the awesome power of eminent domain. Because without this power, we'd have no public roads, we'd have no sidewalks, we'd have no public transport. So I think we all understand that it can be very useful. And we all know what it's been used for traditionally, but it's also been used in a lot of other different ways with a wide range of results. So we've come here tonight to discuss the uses, both good and bad, as well as the outcomes and the effects, both negative and positive. So to start, though, I want to introduce the panelists. And so right here we have Mindy Fully Love, who wrote a book called Root Shock. She's a psychiatrist, and she studied the effects on whole communities, psychologically, psychiatrically, how it affects communities. Brian Berger is a historian of Brooklyn. He's a blogger. He's a photographer. And he and Marshall Berman put together this great book called New York Calling, which they have out front, and it's called New York Calling from Blackout to Bloomberg, and it's just about the way in which cities change. And Tom Engotti is a professor of urban affairs, and I'm going to have the first question for him to just basically get my notes again. But as you know, as a public planner, you have a really good sense of the uses of eminent domain, both currently and in the recent past. So what I'd like is for you to give us a really brief definition of eminent domain in American history and how that use has changed over time. Even more specifically, you know, what are some of the issues at play with the Atlantic Yards? And if you can do that in a minute or less.
Sure. You shouldn't ask a professor that for a minute. Well, basically, eminent domain is the power of government to take private property for a public purpose. It started with British common law. British Crown actually started taking private lands for the purpose of the Crown. And when the U.S. was incorporated, the states, the separate states, were given the power to take private property. For a public purpose, the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution consecrated that right, but also said that government had to pay just compensation for that. Throughout history, eminent domain has been used to build infrastructure, hospitals, community facilities, schools, a lot of things that few people would object to. However, there has always been a very strong anti-takings sentiment, particularly among libertarians, that government should not have the right to take anybody's private, that private property should be sacrosanct. But something basic changed. In 1949, the U.S. Housing Act established the Federal Urban Renewal Program, and it basically gave states and transferred the power to the municipalities the money and the right to use eminent domain to take property to eliminate what they called blight. It was called slum clearance in the 1949 Housing Act. This was the Federal Urban Renewal Program. This was a whole different ball of wax, because now the government's coming in saying, your neighborhood is blighted, we can take your property, because slum clearance is a public purpose. What ensued were decades of struggles by neighborhoods against the Federal Urban Renewal Program and the local allies, implementers of the program. There were two opposition forces, basically. One was the civil rights movement, because a disproportionate number of people who were being displaced were people of color, blacks, Puerto Ricans, in New York City in particular. This was the case. But the other opposition force were the property rights activists, who said, you can't do this anyway. In 1973, President Nixon ended the Federal Urban Renewal Program. Not so much because of his advocacy for civil rights, which was nil, but because of his advocacy of property rights. In any case, that program no longer exists. But the practice has continued. Something else happened in the 1970s, and I'm going to try to end, bring us up to date, which was the fiscal crisis of cities. So cities didn't have a lot of money to undertake urban renewal of any kind. And so the idea that redevelopment should occur initiated by the private sector became very powerful. And of course, before, Robert Moses loved the 1949 Housing Act because he was the master builder in New York, and it was just feeding his appetite for new development and redevelopment. But after Moses and after the fiscal crisis, the public sector was left without power, authority, and money. And the idea we get in what we call the neoliberal period of urban policy is that the private sector has to do it. So the idea that redevelopment of neighborhoods is up to the private sector, to the real estate industry, and government just has to follow. That's what leads us right to Atlantic Yards, because it's the biggest project, the densest project, and it was a project thoroughly initiated by the private sector, by Forest City Ratner. One developer, not several developers, one developer who said, I got a plan, took it to Governor Pataki, who's his pal, Bruce Ratner's pal and friend, and said, this is great. We need the power of eminent domain because there are all these private property owners there. And George Pataki said, fine, we'll make it an urban renewal project under the Empire State Development Corporation, which is an authority under the control of the governor. Empire State Development Corporation went in, and they did a study, which they called the Blight Study. And what is blight? I tell you, I'm a professor of urban affairs and planning. There is no definition of blight. It's a hoax. Blight is in the eyes of the beholder. So anybody can invent their definition of blight. So if you want to take a neighborhood out, you decide what you're going to define as blighted, and then you say it's blighted, and you go take it.
And that brings us to Mindy, who did, 30 years of research on what happens when you do that, what happens to the community. The title of her book is Root Shock, and it refers to...
idea that I had as I listened to people's stories, so talking to people who had lost their neighborhoods 30 and 40 years before under this act that Tom is telling us about, what I heard in their voices was this terrible, enduring pain and loss and grief. And it struck me that this was a very traumatic experience, that they had gotten yanked out of the ground. And I thought of what gardeners talk about root shock when you yank a plant out and you tear the little root hairs and the plant can even die if it's transplanted in this brutal way. So I thought it was a useful term to think about that root shock could happen to people who lost their neighborhood. I had the opportunity with my research group not to do 30 years of research, but to talk to people 30 years later and say, so what happened? People who had lost their neighborhoods, people who had been advocates for the neighborhoods, and people who'd been planners and politicians developing the programs. It was very uniform. The politicians and planners were still pretty enthusiastic that they had wiped out blight. But the advocates and the people who had endured it talked about the loss of the fabric of the city, the fabric of the neighborhood. And the exquisite exhibit that's upstairs and the film that Michael showed and the film you'll see, the film clip you'll see at the end, are really about this fabric in which we live together, which is not something that an individual creates, but it's a collective creation of all of us, that this a neighborhood is so much bigger than a person. It's not something you can buy. It's something you make over time. And in all of their stories, which I tried to transcribe as faithfully as I could, what they told me was that this thing that we make together is extremely precious. According to the French poet and philosopher François Cheng, in yin-yang theory, there's actually a third part, which is called in French the vide médian, the space in between that what we make together. And a neighborhood is... it's this vide médian, it's the space in between all of us. And when bulldozers come in and they destroy a neighborhood, they're destroying this collective precious fabric that you cannot buy, you cannot build, you can only make by living together over time. That's what I learned.
Which brings us to another point that Paul pointed me to Marshall's book, and in the preface there's this one quote which says, to be modern is to live a life of paradox and contradiction. So, you know, within this, there's these small stories that we pay attention to, that I pay attention to as an artist, as a filmmaker. But in the larger context, Marshall, you pointed out the other day that you feel like there is kind of an attack on eminent domain, and it is necessary in many ways, and which is kind of a paradox and a contradiction of our modern life.
I guess there's a few things. I mean, look, one item is, as you said yourself, I mean, eminent domain is a presupposition of every public facility that any of us would attach any value to, any school, any hospital, any library, including this one. Without it, it would have been really hard to build. Now, we've been talking about the libertarian opposition to eminent domain, which is very large and very strong, and emanates from the University of Chicago Law School more than anywhere, and the disciples of Milton Friedman, and it's had a tremendous influence in state courts. One particularly creepy decision had to do with the Ashokan Reservoir upstate, in which there was a lot of polluted runoff that was really damaging the water supply, and the state tried to take some of these houses by eminent domain, and the court in, I guess the district court in Albany said they couldn't. It's taking property, can't. And then eventually the Court of Appeals vindicated the reservoir, because basically, I mean, the way the decision seemed to go was, it's like they said, without doing this, this facility is destroyed, to which the opponents said, well, that's not our affair. You know, you have to build filtration. And they said, well, the cost would be so spectacular it would be beyond our beyond us. And again, the idea was, well, that's not our affair. These are our houses. And Judith Kay basically decided we have to decide this case by case and look what's really going to happen to the people as a whole. And water supply matters more. But I don't know what's going to happen next time because, Arizona is another place that generates this jurisprudence. And I don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do. One thing that could emerge from this is that it will become impossible to create public facilities. And I doubt anybody here really wants that. Okay? So, just sort of keep that in mind. Right. Now, let me just mention a couple of other things. All right. Oh, the developer here, I know there has been a years of valiant struggle against him, and some of you might enjoy an account of another developer like this who's finally brought low in the movie Zohan. Okay? Nobody messes with the Zohan. How many of you have seen that? Check it out. It's great. You know, and it'll be really good for your morale. You know, how to blow these creeps away. You know, just to imagine that they can be blown away. Other creeps will take their place, but it's possible to make a diff. Okay? A thing that's really important, okay, I'm a, and my cousin Marilyn here in the audience are sort of secondary victims of the Cross Bronx Expressway, which was built about a block from where we grew up. And I know we both were pretty traumatized by that, as many other people were. And my book, All That Solid Melts Into Air, in some way, starts in the 18th century, but really was inspired by that. And let's see. Can I talk for a few minutes, or do you want to go around and let me talk later, or what?
Well, it kind of depends. We're talking about largely this project now. We're going to talk about kind of broader issues
okay.
a little bit.
Because I don't know much about the project,
right.
But see Zohan.
Okay. Well, that's what we're going to show the other clip, which talks kind of much more to the broader philosophical aspects of a changing city.
Okay.
Because some of the things you brought up are, like you said, they said build filtration. So I think the reality is there's often a middle ground, and Tom, you were involved in kind of a middle ground approach to the Atlantic Yards, which was the Unity Plan. If you can just briefly, again, we always want brief. Brief is important. Describe kind of what that plan is and what it reacts to. And
okay, I'll try. I first want to make sure that in our conversation we can distinguish between providing clean water for the city and providing land for a developer to build luxury condos or a private basketball arena. I have a hard time in New York City understanding how the stadiums in the arenas, which are receiving deep subsidies, how these get built when kids don't have a place to play.
That brings up a point which we always get to, but it has a lot to do with a thing called media. Because most people, even as you were explaining eminent domain before, I could feel the eyes glazing over because it just gets arcane. There's this organization called the Empire State Development Corporation, and they do X and Y, and everyone's like, just give me the nets. I don't, you know, it's like, and I think that has a big part to do with it. It's difficult to talk about schools, but it's really nice to say we're having a basketball team, or we're building houses, or we're providing 10,000 jobs, which may be 1,000 jobs per year for 10 years, and it's only, you know, things like that that people don't, it's hard to parse, and I think it has to do with how we get information.
And the selling point for all new projects, as your film clip says, is jobs and housing. And of course, housing is always provided, and jobs are always provided, so it's a cinch, it's a slam dunk. Anybody who wants to build anything is going to meet the criterion. The criterion are actually all that simple for economic development. But what I think, and this will get into your question about the Unity Plan, what I think the criteria for new development ought to be, should be much stricter. That they should, when a developer comes in, they should pass muster. After going through a thorough discussion and dialogue with people who live and work in the neighborhood and in the city, and not just the neighborhood and city, but it can and should be a broader dialogue. But in the case of Atlantic Yards, there was no dialogue. It was all a one-way street. It was a done deal right from the time it was announced. But here we are 4 years later, and it ain't such a done deal because it's not happening. It's not happening. It's stalled, possibly permanently. And but you know, just months after the official plan was released, Council person Letitia James convened a group of community people and a community workshop and said, we can do better. We can do our own plan. And they called it the Unity Plan. That was 2004. In 2007, she and the Council of Brooklyn Neighborhoods developed Don't Destroy Brooklyn, a whole coalition of other groups, convened another session to update the plan. What's the community alternative? If you go to unityplan.org, you can actually check it out. But to make a long story short, it's a logical, sensible alternative that fits in with the surrounding neighborhoods. It's not one giant barrier that separates Prospect Heights and Fort Greene, but it's a diverse environment, the kind of environment that Jane Jacobs talked about, diversity in scale, diversity in building type, diversity in population as well. And it tries to fit in and stitch together the neighborhoods instead of creating a barrier between them. It also has sensible jobs proposals, not just jobs in numbers, but what kinds of jobs, real jobs, permanent jobs, long-term jobs, for people who live in the neighborhood, for people who are in the area, and not just construction jobs, because there are always construction jobs. So, you know, jobs that have something to do with the economic livelihood of the neighborhood. So there's a whole series of others, an affordable housing program that's much better than Forest City Ratner's a feeble affordable housing program, which started out 50% affordable housing. When you peel off all of the layers of deceit, it turns out to be 14%. And in the end, it probably wouldn't happen anyway. And in the end, it's all public money that would be spent in any case in Brooklyn. So the community alternative is so much more logical. It comes from the kind of thing that Mindy was talking about, the real relations and experiences and lives of people who live in the neighborhood, who know the area, and who have some visions that, when you actually get right down to it, look a lot better than the grand visions of Forest City Ratner, which is only really, their vision is based on their bottom line.
And that, you know, brings up this idea of vision and vision. Brings up the idea of like what is community and what are stakeholders and you know how does the city change. So you know at this point I want to show another clip, and this is about the artist Arthur Woods and his project and his effort to save his project. This is just a short trailer for it, and then afterwards it'll allow us to kind of broaden the discussion into that broader definition of eminent domain that's brought out by the photo show in terms of the changing city and which hopefully we'll be able to talk a little bit about the books that you guys worked on. So if you want to run that. If you can bring down these lights, too, it would be good.
It used to be a brownstone. No, you can see it from a lot of different places in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the way it stands out. Very interesting.
Depending on your angle of approach, it can resemble a 15th century flying machine, a warped Gothic cathedral, or a pile of sharecropper's shacks poised deliriously over Brooklyn. I live in my head. Some people, they live outside of their head. As far as seeing this way, I see this way. And spend a lot of time in there, so it's very confusing to most people.
So what is this thing?
It's a one-family house that I lived in for 28 years.
Yourself or with a family?
With my family.
Kids have friends over?
Have friends over? Are you kidding? Why not? That house has been written up around the world so far. When you come to Broken Angel, you'll never be the same.
Well, hi. How you doing?
Always better with a hard hat on.
Developer is such a dirty word that people don't realize that every building that everyone lives in New York City was built by some developer at some point. Since, what, 79, when Arthur originally bought the building, he was technically the caretaker who lived in the front of Broken Angel. He lived in the house in the front, not in the workspace in the back. And the apartment buildings, they didn't live this way for a long time.
Lenore back there.
But there was a small fire in October of 2006, and how it started, no one has any idea whatsoever. After that, they let him flout their regulations no longer.
I was arrested, taken away in handcuffs.
I had to pull together a lot of pieces really quickly so that they wouldn't tear the building down. Through negotiations with the Department of Buildings, we were able to get them a proposed timeline as to how long it would take us to legalize the structure.
They're destroying one of my arches.
He has some drawings of the exterior that are pretty elaborate and pretty esoteric and pretty Arthur, which is a great thing, and that's what we're going to build. Out, I would say at this point, maybe 160 or 180 cubic yards of debris already.
You know what? Just imagine, this whole room full. Now we got a path.
If the DOB got their way, they would have trashed the whole building with everything in it. And if I had my way, I would have saved everything. So now it's like 10 guys coming in and, you know, and I have to decide like that. Gradually losing its character.
Now it looks awful. We've removed a lot of the top. Another week and the whole top will be gone. Hey, Arthur's up there right now with the Sawzall. You see him with the harness?
I mean, I think he was a little uncomfortable when we started out, but it really was his decision. I was pushing for a longer court fight.
We've decided that Broken Angel is not a building, it's a lifestyle. Broken Angel is wherever I go and however I live when I get there.
Unbelievable.
And the court is trying to legislate against lifestyles. They want acceptable lifestyles, which would probably include the yuppies, the hippies, maybe, the boomer generation, but certainly not artists. It's hard to be an artist anywhere.
You know, he's not an architect. He's an artist who decided to work on a grand scale, and that's exactly what he's done. He just decided to work on a building and decided to make it into the biggest piece of art he possibly could. We have a real opportunity here to make a landmark where a building was going to be torn down.
So in a way, that movie could be called Broken Angel, From Blackout to Bloomberg, because it really encapsulates that same time period, which, you know, leads to you. And if you can just kind of describe the idea of what you were looking at with the book and about how cities change and where you see it changing. Is it going for the better? Because, you know, just to get to a point, one argument for eminent domain in many of these projects is that it's for the public good. And the public good is that there's going to be more tax revenue because the government needs taxes in order to provide services. So under these definitions, it would be very easy to say this is a blighted, you know, building and we should take it. So it comes to this definition of really, you know, how do we define the public good and how do we define community and how do we find a place for the arts when things become much more about revenue?
My book is, and Marshall's book is, New York Calling, From Blackout to Bloomberg, and it came out last autumn. Basically, there's no single answer, because to any of these questions, things are dynamic in 10,000 different directions at once. And when you lose something, you know, we can talk about like this greater, since we've been focusing somewhat on Brooklyn, this greater decline of Brooklyn. The Dodgers left, the Navy Yard closed. These are significant things. Many people moved out. Many people moved in. From 1970 to 1980, the population decreased, and it's been going up since then. And the Brooklyn of 2000, which is the last time we have full census data for, is so radically different than that of 1950, which, if not the apogee of the Brooklyn nostalgia industry, which we sort of all, anyone who has like an interest in Brooklyn has absorbed these images, is so radically different from that and has so much more individual specific things that we can identify, like taxonomically, that I really try to refute, as an individual, that sort of decline and rise again narrative. And I think Marshall and I, from our different generational perspectives, have a similar view of the period, roughly, of our book, which was from the blackout of 1977 to the present day, which to some people is viewed strictly as like a triumph from financial near ruin to prosperity for a good number of people. And, you know, we don't need to really talk about those that are left behind. But at the same time, I think we both also refute what's becoming really a common, you know, lament about gentrification and the arts. Lower East Side had a great 100-year run as a cultural engine and worldwide generator of literature and theater and painting and all of these different things. If that is over, or if that is in a lull period now because of you know, the increase of real estate there, that's unfortunate, but this thing happened and there are 50 things happening elsewhere in New York City. And the same thing can be extended to Brooklyn. I mean, I absolutely decry Forest City Ratner. A related like malfeasance, which we haven't talked about, but some Brooklynites might know, is this thing called the Brooklyn Bridge Park, which, if you don't know, it would run roughly from the Brooklyn Bridge down to Atlantic Avenue. And somehow, as a society, we've come to a point, I mean, as vilified as Robert Moses is, and sometimes for, you know, very understandable reasons, there's a lot of parks and a lot of pools and a lot of handball courts left over from the Moses era. Now we've gotten to a point where the only way it seems we can have a park, a new park in Brooklyn, is to have it be, in effect, a yard for a massive luxury condo project. And tying into one thing that Tom said about the sports franchises, I've been heartened, like, recently there's sort of been this conversion of what were always similar interests but weren't maybe necessarily tied together about the financing of these sports stadiums and the financing of something like Atlantic Yards. But as Forest City Ratner has had to go back for more money, and the Yankees, the richest franchise in professional sports, that we live in a city, and I know what Michael is saying about how people's eyes glaze over when we talk about the Empire State Development Corporation and all these things. Like, maybe a more clear way that many of us can understand is like to think about the supposed like data and rhetoric we hear when there's a subway increase, all the different crazy figures we get from the MTA, or for those of you who are renters and we hear the landlord side of the rent guidelines board meetings. If we extend like those basic issues, the story of Atlantic Yards and Yankee and Met Stadium deals is really these huge corruption stories at every level. And although, I mean, it takes an insane amount of time and energy to like just fight your way through this virtual reality of propaganda, but just to know at core, you know, that it's been a scam from the beginning is really like a sobering and sort of overwhelming thought. I mean, I'm glad there are people who devote themselves, you know, tirelessly to dissecting this.
No, but, and Marshall, you had some thoughts on.
Let's see.
No, just further on that idea of the changing city and, you know, what are the net positives, what are the net negatives? Because it is easy to kind of vilify development, but, you know, as you say, we still have the handball courts, we still have the parks.
So my net positive, yeah. Quick, like, addition to that is, you know, our ethnic diversity, which people throw out there as like a general, oh, we're so diverse. Well, okay, we are. We can go into the subway and we see all that. But to me, that's okay. That's only the start. I mean, but to go out and say, okay, we have Trinidadians, we have Guyanese, we have Nigerians, we have Ghanaians, we have Uzbeks, we have Georgians, we have Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Hondurans, Salvadorans, all of these things that actually exist. They're not just diverse, you know, and we can point out different neighborhoods and actually the economic vitality that these people have created through their own different social and cultural networks, not from Forest City Ratner, not from the Empire State Development Corporation.
I think, well, that's true.
That's why we're partners.
Yep. I wanted to let's see. There's a certain kind of left discourse, which I certainly participated in my day, which had to do with, like, people who were displaced from neighborhoods, like, were destroyed forever. And I know many people who were displaced felt like that, and I know I felt like that. But it's really wrong. I mean, many people, both in New York and around the world, who were displaced from neighborhoods, go and form new neighborhoods and create new possibilities. And one of the great Broadway musicals, which I know many of you have seen in some or other form, is Fiddler on the Roof, right? How many of you have seen some version of Fiddler on the Roof, including the movie, okay? Remember the way it works? I mean, it's this little town which has lots of problems, but still, it's a community. At the end of it, it gets blown away inexorably, and everybody's got to start packing, and mostly head for America if they can get there. And what's one of the fascinating features of 20th century is that it's like the people who were expelled from places like Anatevka created the culture of the Lower East Side, which was enormously rich, which was completely unexpected. They weren't looking for it, they weren't planning for it, but it happened. Okay. And I think it's important to be open to that. Okay. That people who are displaced and traumatized in one way, their lives aren't over. And in fact, sometimes it attunes them to possibilities of life. See, there's a whole kind of conservative discourse in which once you change anything, it's the end. And I think probably most of the people in this room are more on the left than anything else. And I don't think you really want to buy into that. I mean, that the idea that changing the city at all destroys it. And I know everybody has a kind of nostalgia, which is very one of the most powerful emotions in probably in all life. And there was a wonderful book called The New York Colossus by Colson Whitehead. Do you know that book? Anybody? There's a great line in it, which is, you become a New Yorker when everything that used to be here is much more solid and real than anything that's here now.
Do you have some thoughts on that, just in terms of, you know, yeah, you got to, you know, break some eggs to make an omelet, or, you know, it's time for some people to take one for the team so the city can progress, but, you know, how do people overcome these issues, or, you know, from your experience, having been eminent domained?
Well, I'm a psychiatrist, so I look at this pragmatically, and I'm interested in how do people and how do groups describe their flourishing, and concretely, what have they been able to do? And some groups can manage, if the circumstances are right, but we're always, in medicine, looking at all groups. If you take all groups, what happens? And it turns out that there's a huge problems if you displace people, the losses are enormous. And so the issues are, is there something that mitigates the losses? And if not, then people suffer. And furthermore, none of this history, we've only scratched the surface of the history of urban renewal, but that's not the only displacement that certainly poor and working people and minority people in this country have suffered. So what if you pile on displacements, as we have over the past 40 years, and with each displacement, there's no mitigation? Then you get a situation of health problems, such as we have today in these populations, where you've actually created a new disease ecology, you've created new diseases, and you've created what physicians call comorbidities. That is, the existence of comorbidities. So co, as in things that go together, meaning illnesses that are going together. So you can easily find someone who, through these processes of displacement without mitigation, came to be addicted to drugs and got infected with AIDS and has psychiatric illnesses and has asthma and has obesity and is struggling to manage all of these things. And this is true medical gridlock, because these are new diseases. We have no treatments. We have no treatments for them alone. We certainly have no treatments for them as a constellation of problems. And we have created this not in a single person, but in really millions of people around the world. So I think that while it's true that people do go on, the wish of human beings to stay alive, which as a physician is, that's my stock in trade, is that everybody wants to live. People will stay alive, but boy, are they under rough circumstances. And I don't think we should take that lightly. And I don't mean it as an ideological issue. I mean it as, in terms of our goal, what is our goal? If our goal is to create an exciting and inclusive democracy, then we have to be very respectful that human beings flourish in fairly stable conditions. And part of this context of modernity is a world that's changing very, very, very rapidly. And if we add into that greed and land grabs and displacement without mitigation, we see terrible tragedies like New Orleans post-Katrina. And we have to take those tragedies as object lessons in what this is all about.
Well, one interesting point you bring up in the book is when you have somewhat of a stable community, you may have a number of junkies in that community, but what happens when you rip that community from the ground and push them to the far side, those junkies would know the people in the neighborhood, they would kind of take care of them, and then all of a sudden, these people who were kind of on the edge, there's no one to take care of them, and everyone else is a little bit weak, and so that one junkie becomes five junkies, becomes 10 junkies without any kind of community safety net, and that's when you have kind of the explosions of drug use that we saw. And some of this, it may not be completely scientific. A lot of the points that come up in the book, you might talk about your anecdote about jazz at this point, but it is interesting. There are interesting connections between these things.
You know? Well, it's certainly completely scientific and well understood that the AIDS epidemic becomes such a serious epidemic in New York City in the context of the destruction of neighborhoods and the displacement of populations. I can say with less authority, I'm not an authority on jazz, but that all of the neighborhoods that I have visited and that I have heard about that were African-American neighborhoods were neighborhoods where there were jazz clubs and that were part of the jazz circuit.
Tell us some of those neighborhoods, okay?
So some of those neighborhoods include the Fillmore in San Francisco and the Hill District in Pittsburgh, but even small neighborhoods like the Gainsborough neighborhood in Roanoke had a place where the performers came through. And everybody who was on the circuit in those days went through these neighborhoods. And in a place like the neighborhood in Madison, Wisconsin, which was an Italian, Jewish, black neighborhood, there was no hotel where a black person could stay. So if all of the great Duke Ellington came through, there was a particular house where they would stay. But all the kids in the neighborhood got to hear great jazz. In those neighborhoods where there were these clubs, the clubs were, many of them, pretty marginal businesses. And I estimate that on the order of 1 in 10 was able to relocate, partially because these were near downtown neighborhoods, and there was no place to put a jazz club further from downtown. A jazz club belongs downtown. You can't put a jazz club further out in a residential neighborhood. So they just went out of business. I hope that some scholar will take up this issue of what was the impact of losing, and let's say it was as devastating as I say. Let's say there were African Americans, there were 1,000 cities in the United States that did urban renewal. What if 600 of them had African American neighborhoods, and what if 9 in 10 of the jazz clubs in those neighborhoods was destroyed? That had an impact on the jazz circuit. And it's partly because the clubs are destroyed, but also partly because jazz was drifting, wafting on the air, and people heard it. So Ralph Ellison talks about just listening to people playing music through the doorways and himself trying to master the trumpet and torturing his neighbors. That's what happens in neighborhoods. There are scents in the air, there are sounds in the air, there are colors in the air. And in Broken Angel, that weird thing is in the air. And it's giving everybody a sense of here's where we are.
Yeah, well, for me, living near it was one thing that made me say, I like this neighborhood. There's obviously a creative spirit here. But you know, just as an aside, I was a musician, and I'd once gone across the country, just driving across the country by myself with a friend, and it sucked. You know, we'd find a thrift store, meet nobody, camp out by the side of the road, get hassled by the cops. And then 3 years later, I was in a band, and I went on tour. We made no money, but we went to the exact place in the town that we would want to meet people, and then we would go stay at their house. We'd get free beer and a place to stay. And all those people are still friends of mine. So I can really relate to how important that, you know, community isn't just where you live, but it's kind of where you interact. So if that community is destroyed in many small cuts, I can completely relate to how that would have a huge effect on the ability of these people to communicate and to you know, because normally you'd have two bands play and that band would meet the other band, and that's how things
That's
go.
Exactly what the musicians describe.
You know, it's a good example that community isn't just the physical location. It's the set of relationships between people. Now, you take away the physical location so people have no place to gather, it can destroy those relations. Now, I'm not the nostalgic, and I'm not saying nothing should change. I actually have to differ with Marshall on this, because the conservative argument is anybody who questions those in power who are proposing to displace neighborhoods, individuals, or people is just a nostalgic or against progress or against change. And that's not, because everything changes. Jane Jacobs fought to defend her neighborhood in the West Village against urban renewal, but had a whole set of very detailed proposals about how neighborhoods change, how dynamic a neighborhood is. People move out, people move in. But people in a democracy ought to have the right to participate in a process of change, in determining that change. If you're not in a democracy, if you are powerless, then change happens to you. You're a victim. You're the subject of change, and you're not participating in that change. That's what it's all about.
I just want to say that as a psychiatrist, I just want to say I have a different take on nostalgia. And that is that the term nostalgia is actually coined by psychiatrists hundreds of years ago. And it's coined by psychiatrists who observed that people who moved some distance from their home could actually die of longing for their home. And therefore, this is something that was put forward as a very serious psychiatric diagnosis. And I claim it as such. So I have a different use of the word nostalgia. I think we want to really respect that it's not a little, you know, bittersweet, I'm bittersweet for, you know, my pedal pusher days, but that a home is an object of attachment of profound importance to the human being. As a mother is, as a father is, it's not the primary system, but it's the secondary system of homeostasis, according to John Bowlby, one of the greatest psychiatrists who ever studied object relations. When you destroy this system, you destroy somebody's ability to function in the world. And we must, if we're going to have a healthy society, respect that man does not live by bread alone. We live in systems of relationships. And it's those systems of relationships that keep us safe. Your point, that the junkies are stabilized by the neighborhood because they're the grandmothers who said, you don't do that. Yeah. And you don't do that over here. You do that over there. They control it. The jazz clubs, interestingly, I think that one of the things that happened with heroin, everybody talks about the CIA dropping heroin in the ghettos, but I think one of the things that happens was the destruction of the jazz clubs because heroin and cocaine were used in jazz clubs under very controlled conditions. They were used by the cognoscenti, not by the everyman in the street. Nostalgia, in my view as a psychiatrist, is something that we need to understand and respect. And we shouldn't move on anybody's house without saying, would I like my house to be moved on?
Yeah, I think Mindy makes a number of interesting points. I want to, if I forget when I start babbling, to circle around to your first remarks and bring in the subject which is related to development of, I don't know if there's a more, and any of you might know if there's a better term than environmental racism, but it's something that I notice all the time. Where I live in South Brooklyn, it was in the news today, you know, blogs and certain radio and newspapers can't get over themselves celebrating the opening of a new IKEA. Wow. Yeah. Go wait in line to get your fall apart junk tomorrow, is my little editorial. It's, let's call it 3/4 of a mile from the second largest housing project in New York City after Queensbridge, Red Hook Houses, East and West. One block from Red Hook Houses East is a garbage transfer facility. One block. Imagine if in Park Slope or Clinton Hill or the Upper West Side or any, you know, nice neighborhood that any of us, you know, can read about in New York Magazine, say. If a block from there was a garbage transfer facility with 18-wheeler trucks with municipal solid waste stenciled on the side of it, parked, you know, sometimes 24 hours a day if they get there after it's closed and it doesn't open again until Monday or whatever their hours are. And, you know, I'll sit there and do some Google research. It's never written about. And it ties into, like, going, sort of working backwards from your points, is I'm not necessarily against nostalgia per se, but I would even extend that to one of my criticisms of a lot of the dialogue about Brooklyn is this very selective nostalgia and almost a nostalgia for the way things never were, which is perhaps the most powerful of all nostalgias. But to give an example, you know, we all know Jackie Robinson, and I take nothing away from Jackie Robinson's iconic achievement or significance. Around the time Jackie Robinson comes to Brooklyn, there's 400,000 other black people. Can this is not a challenge to our great audience here, but do we know about any of them? I can name one, and it ties into your jazz thing, Max Roach, who was Charlie Parker's drummer, who was a Brooklyn native, and made this amazing record with Charlie Parker in 1945 called Coco, which, you know, reverberations around the country and eventually nationally. But we have this like view of Brooklyn, like, oh, Jackie Robinson and Don Newcombe, and you know, these very interesting characters, and the Brooklyn Dodgers were a significant cultural institution. But because of migration and population growth in that time, there are these huge populations which have barely been studied. As years go by, they're starting to get some historians who are, you know, looking into these things as they were. Again, in my neighborhood, Latinos, which at that time would have comprised Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and people from Spain, you know, were there as long as the Italians. Eventually, and by the turn of the century, they became not as numerous, but they were there as long as the Italians. If there's anyone who's not Latino from that part of Brooklyn ever hear of that or think of it? So there's all these like stories, both then and now, which I wouldn't even call it like, I mean, people would say it's revisionist history, but it's really like just filling in things that were never told in the first place.
At this point, does anybody from the audience have any questions? Anybody want to jump into the conversation? There's actually, are there microphones on the side, or do you know? No. Yeah, there's microphones on the side, but.
Why don't people get online? Ask people to get online.
Or, no, they're handing it down the aisles. Oh, if you, so, if, yeah, if anybody wants to ask a question, you can ask.
Hi. My name is Gwen Goodwin, and I'm a resident of East Harlem. I've lived there for 23 years. And in 1999, they came to my neighborhood, and they said that we had to have a Home Depot and Costco, and they were to use eminent domain. I want to point out that I know first up and up close all of the points you're addressing. People die under these conditions. The one fellow who was the holdout that went to Supreme Court and ultimately lost, and I was on that case with them, Mr. Minnick, had a 70-year-old cabinet-making business. He employed people that lived in my neighborhood. He paid $18 an hour with benefits. When him and his wife took this on and we all came in to help them, it was a tremendous amount of stress on her family. During this time, his wife developed cancer of the heart. She was one of only four people that have ever gotten this, and she died. Right after he lost the case, his brother died. Mr. Minnick doesn't have a business anymore, and just so you know, his cabinets were so famous and so well made that they were actually in the Museum of Modern Art, and Frank Lloyd Wright had commissioned his family to do his cabinets during the 1950s. So this is a person who has got such a business of integrity. And how he found out about this was he was just flipping through the New York Times one day, and he happened to read how his entire block was going up. This is under Mayor Giuliani. And what Mayor Giuliani did was he gave away five blocks of property belonging to the city to this fellow named Blumberg from Long Island. And they did not have enough land to facilitate parking for this, and they came to our community. And one of the tricks they use, especially in poor communities, is the jobs. And, you know, we started out with 1,300 jobs, and we went down to 700 jobs, and we split that in half because it was a little bit of this, a little bit. Anyway, the bottom line is I want to tell you that it's very personal. People do die. It's not just about nostalgia. And today, I am fighting with the Coalition to Save Harlem, the eminent domain that's about to happen to the entire strip, river to river, of 125th Street. And I would invite all of you to get involved in this project because we are all brothers and sisters in this. And these developers do mean business, and I don't think it has very much to do with the good of the public. This is the arm of the federal government empowering private entities to take your money, your taxes, and your homes. And I really think that people ought to get the crisis. I have never seen as many demolitions as I have in New York City since Mayor Bloomberg. Every year there's 100,000 evictions since he has become the mayor. And I think that this city is in a crisis. And I really, really invite all of you to become active with each other. The people in Harlem and 125th Street right now only think it's happening to them. It is record-breaking what is happening. Columbia University is taking 18 acres of land, displacing 400 people, and you and I, the taxpayers, are going to pay $150 million to help place those people in homes again. And it truly is about stealing land. It's land grabbing, and it's benefiting the rich at the arm of the federal government. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question, I really, really do. I'm wearing a dark suit, so I feel like I should be representing the Republican Party or something here. And as you mentioned, you want the developers to be blown away, as in that film. And, you know, and we talked about, everybody knows how the CIA drops drugs into communities. But is anybody going to take a controversial stance? I agree with you all. I don't like eminent domain. I like property rights. But who's going to take a controversial position here?
We're trying. Do you have one?
No, I do. Okay. Controversial say question. Something different. Who's going to take the side just as devil's advocate for the government? That's what I'm asking. Who's going to admit that maybe Pataki's not a jerk who's in bed with this developer? Who's going to be open to that?
If you can offer any facts to the contrary, I'd be happy to hear them.
So it's proving a negative. So you guys defame somebody. I'm just asking you guys, if you can't be devil's advocate, if it's so obvious, that's fine.
It's actually just
controversy.
It's a very good question. And in a sense, that's one of the reasons I was trying to push the conversation in the direction of discussing, you know, how a city changes rather than saying, let's have a beat up the developer day. Because that's really not the point of this discussion. And that's the jumping point off of the photo show. It's really like, let's discuss how communities change and how people are affected. And it really isn't meant to be that kind of thing.
I'm being sincere. I agree with you that this kind of discussion is very important. And it's actually the kind of discussion that in Atlantic Yards, folks have been asking for 4 years. To have a face-to-face with the governor, with the governor's people, and really talk about whose interests are at stake. You listen to my argument, I listen to your argument. That never occurred. I totally agree with you. That's really missing.
That's what I'm saying. If you ask a seriously controversial question, I'm sure we'd all love to engage it. But
And the reason it didn't occur is because Pataki never wanted it.
I mean, right, would you make a serious refutation of the corruption of New York City and New York State government?
Well, I wasn't put on stage. You put me on stage.
Well, no, but that's the start. Tom is saying... Tom,
but say something nice about these guys and give us something to argue.
No, there was an effort made to get some staunch defenders of eminent domain, but it was not the absolute point of this discussion. But I'm happy to entertain a question about it or have anybody else, you know, stand up and defend it. That's
nobody's willing to play devil's advocate, so we only have one side.
That's not the
wait,
the
maybe
question.
Somebody will.
Please. Yeah.
I would love there to be a discussion in Albany about eminent domain. 34 other states in the U.S. have actually passed laws limiting the use of eminent domain in reaction to the abuse of eminent domain that's occurred all over the country. New York State hasn't even had the discussion. That would be a good discussion to have.
It is an interesting discussion. I mean, the issue of eminent domain does make some strange bedfellows with kind of libertarian, you know, anti-government people, and people who would consider themselves very staunch liberals might find themselves in a situation where they were being eminent domained and they might start to look at it. It was kind of a question I had for lady in the back. You know, before being eminent domain, did you have any knowledge of it or did you understand what it was? I think one of the issues is most people don't really understand what the process is or what's going on. And I think that's kind of an interesting aspect from the media point of view.
Yes, I have the mic. Let me, as a person of color, be one to speak about the sentiment in Harlem as a person of African descent. I think what is missing, critically, part of this discussion is the issue of public policy that is predicated on race and class. And therein lies the not only the dilemma, but really the full scale of the destruction of these neighborhoods, particularly neighborhoods of color. Harlem is a community that presents a catch-22 for the developers, for the Bloomberg administration, for the real estate industry, as well as, ironically, the politicians in Harlem themselves. And I don't mean to sound rhetorical at the risk of being assailed by this person in the back, but I think that everyone clearly understands that it is the real estate industry here in New York City that dominates the politics to a large extent rather than constituents and voters themselves. I think we can all concede to that point. What I want to talk about in particular with Harlem is, let's not talk about the ignorance of Harlem people, because people who just came to Harlem cannot speak about what it is that people in Harlem do not know. Everyone in Harlem is cognizant of the fact that there is a major transformation that is going on in that historic African-American community. The river-to-river rezoning of 125th Street, initiated by the Bloomberg administration, will capture the commercial thoroughfare of Harlem. It is easy for one to understand that when one speaks of a projection of 3,845 units of mostly luxury housing in a 24-block radius from 2nd Avenue to Broadway, mostly luxury housing, that we are talking about a significant change in Harlem. That does not address the 1,100 units of mostly luxury housing in East Harlem. That doesn't address the 500 units south of 124th Street. Nor does it entail the Columbia University expansion in the Western Corridor. Clearly, this is a community that has been targeted for a major, major makeover, because you can see it in the numbers. And of the 5,000 units of housing that have been projected, less than 10% are for families earning $30,000 and below.
Okay, I am hungry for a question.
The question
I really
is,
am. I want, okay. And I want it to
well,
be
was,
a controversial one.
No, that was my background, and I don't want to argue, unlike the other person.
Okay.
So
well,
my question
Paul,
is...
he does want to argue. So.
No, I love arguing.
No. My question is, but you have to have the background before you get
sure,
my question. My question
go for the
is,
question.
Given the tenets of race and class that is defining development throughout New York City, particularly in communities of color and immigrant communities, what is the future of New York City in terms of this rich mosaic that all of the mayors talk about, that all of the politicians talk about, when in fact people of color, are being driven out? And these are people of color who have their own voices and who can speak for themselves. And by the way, we're having a demonstration in Harlem on Saturday at 11 o'clock, and we're going to talk about the issue of displacement.
Well, does anybody want to answer that question?
I will start an answer, and I will say very candidly and with great anger, although I will not express that aspect right here, your future is bleak and not black, and you know it, and that is why.
It's
bleak for the largely African American communities, not just in Harlem.
Yes.
It's happening in downtown Brooklyn. It's happening on the periphery of Bedford-Stuyvesant. I obviously don't know you. You don't know me, but I happen to have, as like my good luck talisman, and if I needed to look anything up, a book which does not address the Harlem aspect of this, but within the context of Brooklyn, but it's applicable to New York City. It's called A Covenant with Color, Race and Social Power in Brooklyn by the historian Craig Stephen Wilder. And I would recommend it highly, as it speaks to a lot of like how a lot of these historical and systemic things, which you're obviously well-versed on, came to be in effect, and why now that your usefulness has expired, policy will be made to bring in new, lighter people. And there's no, a friend of mine, John Straussbaugh, who was a contributor to my book, had a term for it that got a little bit of attention at the time. And he referred to it as benign ethnic cleansing. And that's a pretty good way to put it, because that's effectively what's happening. And it's called A Covenant with Color, Race and Social Power in Brooklyn by Craig Stephen Wilder, and he's a Bedford-Stuyvesant native who I believe is now a professor at Dartmouth University.
Does anybody else want to answer that question?
Where's the demo?
The demo will start in Marcus Garvey Park,
at 124th and about 5th Avenue, and then we're going to go through Harlem, and we're going to end up on 115th and Morningside. Interestingly enough, in terms of the cultural clashes on race and class, which hasn't been discussed, Marcus Garvey Park is now under attack with the new gentrifiers who don't like the militancy that it suggests, and they want the park to be renamed Mount Morris Park.
I think Marshall wants to say something. No?
One thing, I've been teaching at City College in Uptown in Harlem for about 40 years. Okay. One thing that I wanted to say about it is, I mean, it's always been very multinational, and it's been full of people who come from all over the world and who've been through every kind of trauma that you can imagine. And one thing that's really important, it's not the only thing, is that people who've been traumatized can be very creative. And sometimes this drops out of our discourse, and I really want it to be in. And that some of the people who had all those diseases at the same time were making beautiful art, were creating beautiful jazz solos, were becoming rappers. I mean, rap was invented in those horrible neighborhoods, by people who were afflicted with all of those afflictions. Doesn't mean those afflictions were groovy, but it means that there's some very complex reality here. The other thing is about Harlem is I think it's probably more beautiful than it's been any time since the 1920s. And many people I know at City College live there and have lived there for a while. One of the things that a secretary I know who's lived there all her life says that for the first time in her life she doesn't have to cook dinner every night, that there are actually restaurants that she can go to and with her husband and, you know, sit in cafes. And she's been working hard for a long time, and it's nice to have that. And one thing, it's very interesting, the MTA doesn't want us to take the 104 on Broadway. Okay, it wants us to take the 7, which goes on Amsterdam and goes up into Harlem. I'm not sure exactly what the MTA has in mind, but it's an easy way to take a ride into sort of deep Harlem and follow it for 20, 30 blocks. And one of the things you'll see is maybe the most beautiful urban neighborhood you've ever been in. Now, I just want to say I've been there. Okay, I've been through, you know, I've taught there for 40 years, and so much of Harlem has been like wrecked and bombed for so long, and now it's basically been built up and people are living in it. And a great many of the people who live there now and who are living in housing projects and who aren't rich and who aren't gentry are very grateful for that. You know, maybe they have a low consciousness, but you know, the idea that they can go and sit in outdoor restaurants is kind of nice. Okay.
Yeah, but can they afford the meal?
Well,
point that Martin Luther King made is that, you know, they fought for 40 years in Harlem to make a better neighborhood, and now the very people who struggled to stay can't afford to stay or eat in the local restaurants. Burden is going to eat in the restaurants on 125th Street, the head of the City Planning Commission.
I think, but in general, Barbara Ehrenreich had an article in The Nation which said, if it's beautiful, you can't afford it. I think that's probably true in general. But I think, the people I know, the secretaries who are going to eat in the restaurants, I think, and who are very happy, you know, and who feel like, you know, they don't have to worry about, you know, when it gets dark, which they did 10, 20, 30 years ago, are onto something.
Which is another part of nostalgia, which we tend to remember the good, the things that we liked about something and not as much the bad.
But take the 7. It's a really fabulous neighborhood. It's dazzling.
Next question.
This is number 7. Okay. Michael White, lawyer, urban planner, noticing New York. The dissents in Kelo contain some prophecies which I think bear out. O'Connor said that eminent domain for economic development. I'm sorry. It's the case that's currently permitting eminent domain to be used where it's being used in the country and in New York and Atlantic Yards for economic development purposes. And she prophesied that that kind of eminent domain was going to be used only by the rich, powerful, and politically well-connected to add to their wealth. That's bearing out. Thomas predicted that eminent domain was always going to be used against the poor to take away from them. No one prophesized, and I wonder if you think that this is happening, and it ties in with some of the squabbling, I think, that you're having, that what would happen is, as in Atlantic Yards and as in Columbia University, the developers would focus to do their land grabs in neighborhoods which were on their way up. So in essence, they look to knock the poor off the up escalator. The other thing is, that's because they're attracted to the higher element of profit there, I think. Would anyone like to take a stab at quantifying the eminent domain windfall operative in, say, Atlantic Yards, where I think we're talking about close to 8 million square zoning feet, taking a reasonable buildable square foot and figuring that about 60% of the property is area where eminent domain is operative, I think you come out to somewhere like 1.3 billion total, and from that you've got to do some subtractions. But how much eminent domain windfall is driving things in Atlantic Yards?
If Tom wants to jump in with some figures, I would be stunned. I mean, I just don't think that's something we can quantify.
Only Far City Ratner knows.
extemporaneously, but a couple of the theoretical points that you're making there, I think, need to be brought out. And I sort of summarize like Kalo, and someone can contradict me if they feel, but it's the principled left and the principled right both are in agreement here, and people with sort of more, where their allegiances are stronger to certain political parties or business interests, tend to like find a blurrier area in the Kalo case, which just as an armchair person, when that came down, you know, my heart sunk. But I thought it was interesting that when it did happen, that a well-known African-American congresswoman, Maxine Waters, was one of the people who spoke out against it. Because as Mindy was saying, and Tom, pretty much everyone here has seen that historically it's been used against lower class and communities of color. Certainly the aspect of Atlantic Yards being adjacent to, more or less adjacent to Park Slope and Prospect Heights, which is you know, now a very desirable and increasingly affluent area, and likewise with Fort Greene and others, they didn't seek to put the arena. The only you know, aspect in favor of the arena being there that they did have, you know, is the Atlantic Avenue and Flatbush Avenue, you know, transit hub, which of course the flip side of that is that it's already a horrific surface, you know, nightmare. In the hope that, you know, if they really think that 90% of those people were going to take, you know, trains or buses, whatever the actual figure seems pretty unrealistic. One thing I'll also throw out there, and anyone can jump in the bad faith, which has marked this from the beginning, is that Forest City Ratner had these two horrible malls, Atlantic Center and Atlantic Terminal, and eminent domain was brought out, or you know, proffered as a necessity when, and certainly like the, nobody defends the first one, which I believe is Atlantic Terminal Mall, and that was not included as something that could be redeveloped in part of this larger plan. It was just, you know, an absurdity from the beginning, but one which, other than in the activist people, has rarely been brought out as, you know, just a base refusal of self-examination. You know, they've done these studies to claim blight and to, you know, say why this is so necessary, but without putting any scrutiny on their past development history in Brooklyn.
Can I just add a quick thing, because I know there are lots of other questions, but there is never any public accounting of costs and benefits, and there hasn't been in this case. who benefits and by how much, and who loses and by how much. And parallel to that, if you study the history of urban renewal in this country, you'll see that there has never been a public commitment to even investigate or study what happens to people who are displaced. Never. In the 20 years of the Federal Urban Renewal Program, it was one study. And that's how little concern there is for the people who are forced out as a result of these programs.
There's time for just one more question. Take an next question. There's one here, and then we'll get you.
Yeah, I want to say that the what's happening...
I really want a question.
Okay, I have to... Well, I think that we've seen two different phases of development. Like in the past, we've seen housing built, we've seen industries built. You know how today they promise jobs and housing. In the olden days, cities like Detroit and industries like the auto industry were built in this country, and it was really jobs and housing for people that would do the jobs. Now, in today's day of automation and the export of industries and jobs, the large portion of the population that used to be working class is no longer needed. And what we see is a gentrification that's going on as a form of genocide. It's not just like some people suffer from displacement. It's that people are being pushed out of everywhere, and there is nowhere to go because the people that are investing in these projects have no more use for most of us to keep on producing profits for them. How do we address that? I know on the Lower East Side, we have the Tompkins Square Park movement. It was an insurrection against genocide. And if you paid attention, just last night, there was another large confrontational demonstration that shows that movement is picking up again. It was a whole neighborhood rising up in the streets, fighting the police on a daily basis to resist genocide, to create a zone of resistance, and looking forward to a liberated zone and a revolutionary outlook. I'd like to know what people on the panel feel, how this system can be replaced so that we have a system based on human needs instead of private profit at the expense of human life.
I'll jump in with a brief answer to that. Rhetorically colorful presentation. I don't disagree with you in spirit. I would probably hesitate to use the word genocide in case there are Armenians or Eastern Europeans or Gypsies or the descendants of enslaved African Americans or Native Americans here. It's bad, but you do have freedom of mobility and options that other people did not have in history. And certainly while the greater American and New York industrial decline, is something that we can quantify, I do want to make a point that in all five boroughs, even Manhattan, there are still numerous small industries and even medium industries that are doing quite well. And sort of as a corollary to all this, it's not only people on the margins of residential living who are affected by this developmental pressure, but also industrial concerns, whether it's in Williamsburg, in Greenpoint, Red Hook, Gowanus, South Bronx, any place that gets the attention of this, these industries, or the real estate industry that you're concerned about, affects both residences and the jobs, some of which are still here. We could do an industrial tour of New York City, and that still exists. And it's an important rhetorical point to not get into this whole, post-industrial. Well, if we want to get, very conceptual and historical, sure. But no, in fact, there are many working industries and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of industrial jobs throughout the city.
We have time for one last question here. I thought only comedians said that.
I wanted to know whether some of you could address the question of public services and the response of that to development. For example, the increased pressure on the public school system and so that they're building in neighborhoods and there aren't schools that are there to, and the schools that are there are crumbling. So.
Yeah, I mean, you're the one to talk to that.
You should ask a planner. Ask the city planning department, which has rezoned dozens of neighborhoods throughout the largest set of rezonings for development, for the most part, throughout the city. And in each one of them, there is an environmental review where they're supposed to look at the potential impact on schools and public facilities. You would think that there's some planning going on, that when you get 10,000 new residents in a neighborhood, the city is actually planning to build a school. They're not. And they made promises in Greenpoint Williamsburg when they rezoned them. They're not meeting the promises. There is no planning going on. The idea is, again, this mythology that was started with the fiscal crisis, that all government can ever do is respond to the private sector intervention. And by the way, the main industry in the city now, if you haven't figured it out, is supposed to be real estate. Yeah, show me a society in the history of the human race that has lived on real estate.
And on that note,
Roman.
They didn't. Yeah, they went down on real estate too.
That's true.
Well, I've been told it's the final. That was the final question. One final quick question. Yell it out.
I was just wondering, in bringing the discussion a little bit more back to the community, and we talked a little bit about psychological consequences of displacement and about nostalgia, and I think what... Can everyone hear me?
In bringing this discussion a little bit back to community and thinking about nostalgia and the psychological consequences of displacement, and I think in a lot of New York's thriving ethnic neighborhoods, we see nostalgia for other places, whether it's Latin America or India or Asia, side by side with the creation of neighborhoods, the nostalgia actually plays a part in the creation of those neighborhoods. And I was wondering if anyone on the panel has anything to say about dynamic relationships among displaced people whose places are no longer there, as in eminent domain cases where buildings are destroyed and people have to leave, those populations interacting with immigrants who experience a different type of displacement, maybe different types of psychological consequences. And just if anyone has anything to say about that.
I might say something before the panel actually responds. We have the great honor here of having the artists of the exhibition, Eminent Domain, and perhaps one of the artists, or two of them, three of them, four of them, would like to contribute to this conversation and maybe answer that question or speak to anything that might interest them.
Could they identify themselves, or?
Yes. I see some faces looking at me. I'm not sure if they're looking
at me.
We've
seen some of them. Many of us have admired the show, and we'd love to, say thank you.
Okay, I felt you wanted to say something.
I'm not sure I do, but...
what's your name?
My name's Rainer Leist. My project is called Window. I'm, in fact, living in a Manhattan neighborhood that is highly contested, Midtown West, where a lot of this gentrification has been going on. One thought that I want to share is maybe related to this psychology of this situation of gentrification, is that people who, many of us are here, I don't know exactly the percentage, but are immigrants. We come from other places. And as the previous question pointed out, we come from other communities. Some of us may long for those aspects of communities that are no longer accessible. And suddenly we're faced with a situation where even though we've made the leap to go to another place, to arrive at another place, we did that on our own accord, many of us, some perhaps didn't. But here's this extraordinary counterpoint where suddenly, even though we made that leap, we're told we cannot stay there. We cannot stay in that community. We can't stay in that house. We can't stay in that workshop that an award-winning piece of furniture was made for decades. So it's this absolute psychological counterpoint for me that can destroy a life, that can destroy a community. And I think that's the benefit of that discussion to me, that I've come to realize that there is such a deep connection psychologically that, you know, when confronted, you realize how powerless you are, perhaps after making a journey that, you know, you believed was to empower you. So I think there's a really significant contradiction, you know, on the negative side. I mean, it can turn out very positively too. You know, ironically, as life can act, you know, it can in fact, lead to great art and other things. But you know, it can significantly destroy you. And I think I much appreciate the contribution we heard before. You know, that someone who's made all this great work was pushed aside by someone who was more powerful. And that as a society, we respect power and perhaps money more than other things that are extremely important to us as a society. I think should worry us.
Can I jump in for a second?
You may certainly. Yeah. No. I'm
sorry. Well, I'll go briefly. Or do you want to go?
I don't really have to say anything as an answer to the last question, but I would like to refer to something which was said several times before. Oh, my name is Bettina, and I'm the person who surrounded the five boroughs of New York City. Bettina Johes. And I'm living in New York since 7 years, and I've noticed more and more that people are already moving, and they're moving further out. Like when I came here, actually the first time I lived here in 97, people were still living in the East Village. People I know, which are mainly artists. Nowadays, they're moving to Ditmars Park, they're moving to Sunset Park. I've even heard of artists moving to Coney Island. And there was this comment coming up several times that something gets destroyed, but at different places, something new develops. But it's a different thing, because when I talk to artists who were like starting in the 70s, like Dan Graham, Dara Birnbaum, and so on, they have a whole community. They all lived in Soho, the Lower, or what's called nowadays, Soho, NoHo, the Lower East Side, in this area, so they were close to each other. Well, nowadays, the artists get more and more, even like, you know, they got moved over to Brooklyn. I have a whole other little community of artists up in Harlem, but people get so far apart that it makes more difficult to create a community.
But at the same time, if you look at something like Soho, no one was living there, and a few artists moved there, and they became very close because there was a scarcity of people. And I think the same thing is probably happening at Ditmas Park. There's communities of artists who probably wouldn't have met each other except they're the few artists that are living there, so then they become closer. And so these new communities do form. And, we say, oh, these artists were all in. I mean, it doesn't seem like it right now. It doesn't feel as easy to see it happening. But you talk to some of those artists who lived in Soho. They were the five artists who lived there, and that's how they got to know each other.
But they were very central, and they were central to, you know, even if at that point galleries were still in Midtown, it's still like, you know, that's a 15-minute commute or something.
There is a reality of geography.
Yeah.
There are central places in cities, and if you can be in those central places, it has powerful effects, especially for anybody's creativity. So to be poor, but to live near downtown, to live on the Lower East Side, to live in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, to live in Soho is a powerful thing. To be further out is a different geography. This is a profound reality, and it has effects on communities and can destroy. There are kinds of things that can't survive under different geographies, like jazz clubs.
And communities have effects on artists, because in every community that's fighting gentrification, there's a group of artists that are also fighting gentrification because they see the value of their place. There's also another group of artists that are just packing their bags and merrily going on to the next neighborhood.
But the paradox is that as soon as an exciting art scene is created, the market will move in. It'll make the neighborhood appealing.
The paradox of modernity.
Well, I just want to quickly address what I thought was a very sophisticated observation and question on the part of that woman, about sort of these multiple layers of nostalgia, and that people, immigrants, come and sort of recreate aspects of the places they left. And in some ways that can be contrasted with people, with natives or long-term migrants who have been here and are forced to a place within their city. I spend a lot of time in different ethnic neighborhoods, and the reason why there are so many Pakistanis here or so many Haitians here is because things are so radically fucked at home. They still...
I should have bleeped that, but go ahead, yeah.
They still... the FCC gave me a dispensation. They want to recreate the aspects of their culture here that they like, but there's no illusion that they're going to return in their lifetime and probably ever. But that is a very interesting dynamic when we go to these different places and you see, you know, what if we haven't been, you know, I haven't been to Bukhara in Uzbekistan, but I can go to, you know, Uzbeki restaurants and shops in Brooklyn, so I can only make a vague comparison, but they don't want to give up their Uzbeki or Pakistani or Haitian or Trinidadian, any of those identities, but they are very glad to be here where they can keep their identity and have many more economic and social options than they did back home. Whereas if these artists who come here and enjoy it, or even native New Yorkers, are there any in the crowd? You know, if you've been forced to move, you know, from one place to another, or your friends have, it's sort of a different relationship with the past. I find that there's no right or wrong, but I thought it was very, you know, wise of you to note those differences.
Well, we have 57 minutes left to visit the exhibition, so I very much recommend we stop here, thank our panelists. I'd like to end with one little quotation about nostalgia. Milan Kundera once said something that I think goes to the heart of a lot of what was said today. He said that a European is someone who longs for Europe. Thank you very much.